The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from the Radio X studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here's your host, Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is Stone Payton, joined in the studio by Todd Snick. What's happening, Todd?
Not much, Stone. How are you this morning?
I am doing well. So what's been going on with you, man?
Well, you know, I have some exciting news to report about our flagship sponsor. Everybody knows that our sponsor is PSI, the Digital Media Experts. Before I share the big news, PSI, they manufacture the CDs and DVDs, and I think they're probably the industry standard in terms of quality, and they do the turnkey e-commerce solutions and the streaming high definition video. But our big news is we had a guest on our show about, I guess it was 2 weeks ago when we had those gentlemen.
Yeah, it wasn't very long ago.
Chris Coates, who's their marketing director, he and his wife had a baby last week.
Oh, wow.
So we can welcome Maxwell into the world. So it's exciting to see the High Velocity and the PSI family growing.
Yeah, congratulations, Chris, and welcome to the world, Max. So who'd you bring with you this morning?
Well, we have an exciting guest with us this morning, a prominent Atlanta attorney and recognized technology space thought leader, and Martin Tilson. Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell our audience what you do and how you do it.
Todd, I'm a corporate transaction lawyer that has worked in the technology field for a long time. I built the technology practices at Long Aldridge, which is now called McKenna Long Aldridge, and Kilpatrick Stockton. In the last few months, I've taken some time off to look at what's going on in the legal market and some of the changes coming, and they're significant.
Well, we're excited to have you here, and Stone, we got to stop having all these guests that have far more IQ points than you.
It makes it tough to keep up,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I know. We want to try to look somewhat intelligent on this show. But, hey, Martin, let's get into it. As I said, you're a recognized thought leader in the technology space, but being a prominent attorney, I have been sensing in the marketplace, and I've been doing some reading, that the legal profession itself is changing. We're all seeing how the new media, the new marketing is affecting big business and corporations and how they're going to market and how they're presenting this. Is that same thing happening in the legal community?
Very much so. And I think what you have to look at is who are the buyers of legal services. In most all cases, it's corporations of some size or shape, whether they're small startups or they're large Fortune 500. They're looking these days far more for value. The value meaning they want something predictive they can put into a budget. Many, many, many years ago when the billable hour started in law firms, and that was probably in the 60s, it started a process and a model for the way that legal services were provided. It's become far more inefficient, mainly because the billable hour is the measure. And you get that by leveraging associates and junior partners through a process kind of like a pyramid of work. Over the past few years, we've had some significant increases in the prices paid to associates coming out of law school, somewhat in a competitive manner. And as that has happened, also continue to have rate increases. So law firms, to a great extent, are like everyone else in this economy today. They're going to have to adapt. And the adapting part is about collaboration. The in-house counsels for companies, those whether they're a general counsel or a group of 20 or 50 or even 500 like AT&T, they are pressured highly by budgets, and having predictability in that is very important. So they want good lawyers. They want lawyers that they know their company and industry, but they're looking for value. So value in the collaboration is the key.
So do you find that corporate counsel, is there sometimes a little bit of a contentious relationship between in-house corporate counsel and then external specialized counsel?
Well, I'm not sure that they kind of need each other. You're not going to be able to build within one company all the facets that you need from tax to labor and employment to a variety of different disciplines, some of which are boutique types of practice. But from litigation to IP, you're having different people who know different industries and subject matter. So it's very important to know that subject matter. I think what you're seeing is it started in 2001 to 2003 in that last economic tumble, and that is that budgets were cast upon the general counsel in these companies, and they now have to face that every year through the budget process, and they're getting pushed harder and harder to reduce those costs. There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about the billable hour, how it's under attack, and in this recession, this economy, I think, has moved it up about 2 years of what GCs really want, and that is more predictability, but also they're looking for fixed prices for work, and somewhat formulaic, but it can be done.
We're seeing a White House that in a government that is pushing more regulation. How's that going to jive?
There's no doubt there's going to be a lot more regulation coming. You're seeing it every day, and it's only been 8 months into the term of the first our new president, and it's coming from the House and Senate as well. So more regulation means more law, which means more lawyers.
How about that?
You know, they talk about us like rats that multiply in the laboratory, and it's kind of true. But we live in a legal system. That's what makes America very special. It is one that is ruled by law. And as these regulations come, whether they're involving the financial community, banking, or a variety of others, labor and others, companies are going to continue to need people to interpret those and to help them deal with how they make that work in their companies.
Well, you know, a lot of our listeners, Martin, are in the professional services arena. What insight, if any, can you give us that maybe could help some of our listeners in marketing their services?
Well, I think we have to think about the entire economy. This is an economy of adaptation. We are not going to see the type of economy we had 2 years ago. That's not a bad thing if you learn how to adapt. Look at doctors who have had to adapt significantly and will continue to have to. I'm having a number of conversations with large consulting firms about how they're going to have to change the way they do things to meet the market need. So if you look at lawyers, it's the same thing. What does the market want? It wants good legal representation, but at a good value. So throwing pages of billable hours at the customer who is an in-house counsel or whoever's handling it inside a smaller company does not help the case. And I think what you'll see is an adaptation of model. It won't happen overnight. Some firms are beginning to do some fixed fee things, but they're not changing the initial model, which is one based on leverage and billable hour. Until that changes, they can't really deliver the full suite of things that in-house counsel are looking for.
You touched on a key word earlier when you were talking about how the legal model is changing, and that's collaboration. And I know that's something that you've thought a lot about. How is collaborative systems and collaboration, how is other parts of the economy, how will they benefit from using and applying collaboration in their systems?
Well, let me use the legal one to begin with. This is not meant to be a fight between legal counsel on the outside and those inside. The whole idea is that the legal counsel outside augments or supports or helps give more depth to the in-house counsel. But the important thing there is that the in-house counsel is now being pushed, in many cases, by the CEO and board to manage down more, which means they need more tools. I've spoken to and have continued conversations with two global software providers. They're currently working on new software for in-house counsel that allows them to manage down to the sub-matter of projects, which allows them to make decisions further into the work, which may save money, may make decisions that they stop doing something that they were pursuing because they see it's not worth the money to do it. But in any case, if you take that and you look at everything else we're doing, be it a restaurant, any types of businesses today, you have to look at who your customer is, what your customer wants, and that's changing, as we all know.
Well, it certainly is. And, of course, we know you have specialized expertise in the technology sector. Tell us, what is it that's different about providing legal counsel and thriving in that sector versus, something broader than that?
Well, we all know that electronics and the speed of information has made a change in all of our lives. Think about that from the concept of a lawyer who is meant to solve problems, but usually taking some time to think through them. I remember when fax machines first came in many years ago, and that speeded up the process. But obviously what we're wearing on our belts or in our pockets, the PDAs and other things that are immediately streaming information at a great velocity means a lot of people in the legal profession are having to make quick decisions. They'd rather not do that. They'd rather have a little time to think through it, both with their teams and with the outside counsel. And that's what I'm suggesting is more communication between those who are on the demand side of the equation, those who are the in-house counsel, and those outside will lead to better results.
Do you mind if we shift gears on you here for
sure.
a minute? I've got a lot of questions, and I know our listeners probably do as well, around this whole idea of private equity, venture capital. Just get us educated about that and share some of your experiences around those two ideas.
Well, those are tough topics right now, as you can imagine. Let me start by explaining that most funds, whether they're venture funds or private equity funds, are set up legally as a 10-year life, so that you have the general partners, those that manage the fund and make the allocated investments, running that based on the investment from the limited partners. In many cases, that's individuals. In most cases, it's large institutions. As we all know, large institutions have taken some big losses in the past year, particularly endowments at universities and other places where pension funds and large amounts of capital are there, and they've had some small percentage they would invest in alternative investments, i.e. private equity, venture capital. These funds, as you can imagine, if they're 10 years old, they typically want to have more than one as they move forward. So a fund that was started in, let's just say, 2000 is now 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of those fund cycles, and usually around the sixth year, they're trying to exit and begin to return the money to the investors, and obviously at a much higher percentage than the investors would get in the stock market or anywhere else. They're hoping to get towards a 30% return on investment. That's rare. But if you can get in the upper quartile of all the venture funds, and there are not that many in the country, there's only about 2,000 private equity and venture funds in the United States.
Now, see, that surprises me. I would not. I guess I had it in my head that there were a lot more than that.
It is surprising, but you have to understand that these are all pools of money made by investors and run by a select group of people. The thing happening now is that some of the vintage funds, say of 2000 or 1999, that were started during a big bubble in technology, are finding that they're not able to exit. They're also finding they have a little bit more problems in their portfolio of companies that they can't fix. So it will make it difficult for them to raise another fund. And that has giant implications as we move forward. Because as we know, this country's built on small business. And small business has been our strength both nationally and internationally. As early stage companies are coming along, it's going to be harder to find that early stage money that gets them to the next route of growth and maturity. We need that continually to grow and build companies like an ISS in Atlanta, Georgia, that started in the dormitory of a student and grew to become a $500 million company that was bought by IBM.
Now, is part of your practice dedicated to advising small business that's going after some of this capital?
The interesting thing about my practice is it has been broad. On the one hand, I have worked significantly with smaller, growth-oriented companies, both in advising them in their growth, but also helping them access capital. At the same time, I've worked on a retainer with many companies, Scientific Atlanta, Turner, and many others, looking for synergistic technology that they could purchase or invest in that they need in their own businesses.
Martin, we talked earlier about that we should be expecting to see more regulation coming out of Washington. Is there going to be an impact on the private equity market? That regulation going to affect that in some
way? Well, there's some great fear. It was started back in probably January, February. But the way that a venture capital or private equity fund works, we've talked about the time period, but the group that runs it typically get between 1.5% to 2% of the money in the fund as a management fee. That covers their cost of travel, overhead, hiring people up. It's the cost of doing business. There's also, on the back end, carried interest, and typically that's 20% that they receive after they've exited and returned money to the investors. There's some legislation being talked about that would treat that 20% as ordinary income. It's currently treated as capital gains, which is at a much better tax rate. Ordinary income would make it a less attractive one and could eventually see less venture and private equity funds formed if they make it so less. You know, this is high risk money, and they're looking for high rewards by seeing big wins out of their portfolios. If you're going to take high risk, you need to do it for a reason. And if the reason is that if it becomes difficult to really make a big return, then those investors are going to find some other place to go.
So if the High Velocity Radio Show decided we wanted to expand, we wanted to go nationwide, we needed capital, you know, we're a small shop, what are some do's and don'ts, some things we ought to do to properly prepare so that we might even be seen as someone worth talking to about investing in?
Well, you have to dress better, Stone, to start with.
Well, we're out.
Oh, well.
Well, fortunately, this is a radio show, and y'all have radio faces, but I am.
That we do.
I just lost my coffee all over the mic.
Well, you're a small business, and I delight in helping small businesses. Obviously, a business strategy is number one. It doesn't have to be lengthy. Some people think they have to build 50 to 80 page business plans. They don't. 5 to 20 is fine. But basically, that's your blueprint of where you're trying to go, how you're going to get there, what kind of team you have to get there, and what it's going to cost to get you there. The cost part then becomes the investment part.
Martin, could you explain simply the difference between private equity and venture capital? I mean, is there a difference?
Todd, there is, and it's not like a black line, but in most cases, venture capital is higher risk investment. There are fewer of those, and they tend to go a little bit earlier in their investments. They're looking for companies that will grow at such a significant pace that they will return a great deal of money on the back end.
What is a reasonable amount of equity to give up to get the capital that you're after?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the question is, look at it as a pie. And if you try to hold on to all the pie, you're not going to get a whole lot of investment. So you're looking at your investors as partners. And in many cases, they'll serve on your board. And you have to look at them just as hard as they look at you, because at some point they're going to be sitting next to you and trying to drive decisions along with you. The pie, if you try to hold on to a giant slice and not share more of it with the investors or those on your team, there's potential that you won't make as big a company. You may not be as successful. Whereas if you recognize that by taking that and taking them as a teammate, you can potentially grow this company 50 times more, then how big is your piece of pie? It's pretty large.
Yeah. And so is there ever a viable business case for giving up more than 50% of the company?
Well, you know, you take money at different times. And so some of that has to do with the growth cycle of the company. In many cases, particularly those that are based on ideas back in the 99, 2000, 2001, they were basically young guys with small plans and big eyes and getting $10 million thrown at them, and they learned how to spend a lot of it very fast. But losing control is really what you're asking about. And you have to understand that even in cases where investors have a minority share of the company, they typically have things built into the agreement that if certain things happen, usually bad things, they have some ability to take charge of the board and to fix things. So even though you may hold a majority of the stock, if you're not doing the right thing or your team's not or they're stumbling or falling, investors do in many cases have ability to step in and try to fix it.
I get the sense that you've got your finger on the pulse of a lot of trends, nationally and internationally. Just from your perspective, what do you think are some hot areas for growth in general?
Well, obviously healthcare. And I think most people are staying on the sidelines right now, waiting to see what happens in Washington. And that's one that's probably longer than we have time to talk about. But if you take a subset of that, and it's a fairly obvious one, that's senior care. We have the largest number of baby boomers and people aging. I'm looking around the room here, and I see a few of us.
He's not referring to me, but Lee and Stone, yes.
Yeah. Well, you have to understand that it's a large demographic number, and it's coming every year. At this point, there is not enough senior care to take care of that, meaning independent living quarters, nursing quarters, farther down the chain, nursing to Alzheimer's. We're going to have people living longer. They fortunately, in most cases, are the generation that saved their money and didn't take high risk with it. So they're going to be able to, in some cases, afford it more, unless they give it to their kids. So in terms of healthcare, the big thing coming down the track is a lot of aging people who are going to need some sort of care and certainly some sort of housing. The market, those who provide that right now, is very fragmented nationally. There are all kinds of different models. And some people think this is purely a real estate play. It's not. It's an operating play. How do you serve those in your care and operate efficiently and make some money?
Todd, you were talking about our new flagship sponsor earlier, and you know, of course, they're in the CD digital media business, and it brings to question for me, because I know you're on top of so much of this stuff, Martin, what's happening from a legal perspective in the whole entertainment industry with the distribution of music and this intellectual property and that kind of thing?
Well, we're finding that really the regulations, the ways to protect things, copyright, are just not adequate. And the rise of the internet is the reason for that. We're also finding that in many countries outside the United States, there really are no restraints. So on most any day that a DVD is made by an artist, within 24 hours, it's on the street in Hong Kong or some other place that's been copied. Same thing goes with movies. So there's some desperation in those who are making the art, who are filming things and are making the music, that in many cases, particularly online, as much as 95% of the online downloads are being done without payment, meaning it's being stolen.
Todd, we're losing money every Monday. Someone in China is going to download this thing tonight, and we're out.
the royalties that we're losing are staggering.
I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
No. The music industry is really evolving from being a provider of physical products, discs you take home to whatever you name it, to a service industry. And we know that over time it will be mostly downloadable. But interesting, in at least the music business, some things are changing that I've been noticing, and that's because I have a kid in college and one in high school. And that's the rise of these large concert, particularly in the summers, like Bonnaroo and others, where they gather literally thousands of people for multiple acts of musicians. Some of those musicians, like Coldplay, just released their latest album totally online with no hard copies. So there's a lot of testing going on, but
no hard copies at all. No vinyl, no CD.
I'm not sure that there are.
Wow. And I should know who Coldplay is, and I'm going to find out when I get home. I'll ask my teenage daughter.
And the fact that you said vinyl tells our audience about how old you are.
But no, seriously, though, the no hard copy stuff.
Well, I'm using a very unusual example, but yeah. It's the cutting edge of it.
Yeah.
Now, these concerts are not inexpensive. You go to a Bonnaroo and you pay $150 for 2.5 days or whatever. You get to sleep in whatever weather there is, and you get to buy whatever they have there to sell. Not quite like Woodstock was, which was a one-time happening. These are well-organized, very well-financed, and expected to make a lot of money. And that's why you see more and more of these artists going to them, from Springsteen to The Who to you name it, contemporary and new ones like Coldplay. And those types of artists have started to see that their incomes are getting augmented significantly by participating in these types of giant concert activities. And then, of course, they're going on the road for a year now. If they're going to do a multi-city tour, it's not 20 cities anymore. It might be as many as 50 to 70.
That's an interesting paradox. The more digital we become, the more live labor these artists are having to engage in. That's interesting. I've never thought about it from that perspective.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Martin, I think it's safe to assume that what upended the music industry was the internet. And the internet as we know it is still really only 15 years old and pretty young. I'm curious to know what you think, if you spend any time monitoring the internet and social media as I do. There's a big conversation going on about how the internet and all that implies is affecting like the delivery of news and with newspapers. What are your thoughts on how this is going to impact a hard copy of a real newspaper. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, Todd, I think the killer app for the internet is people, and people now control the news, and they control whether it's television, watching these iReporters who happens to have a whoever has a handheld device that can film something. They're becoming the reporters, whether it's accurate or inaccurate, whatever it may be.
As Todd holds up his flip cam.
Todd's got a giant flip cam here that I'm concerned he's had on the whole time.
No.
But it enables people to connect with other people in such a large way that it's almost hard to understand. I mean, Web 2.0 has become the future for advertising. You're seeing more and more where advertising firms are having to move to the social networks to get the money they need to stay in business, quite honestly. Sponsorships and other things like that are going to change. But, the internet's going to continue to become more pervasive with access anytime, anywhere, and that's really what people want. I think, back to your question, it has speeded up all business. Whether that's good or bad, I think we have to look at different instances. But certainly speed is the word, reaction is the word, and sometimes there's not enough time to really think through what you should be saying or doing. Twitter is a phenomenon that really kind of has surprised me. Of course, they're not making any money, but they've become a household word. They're in cartoons and magazines now. They're talked mm-hmm. about by the president. You know, I'm not sure I want to sit there and watch whatever someone's talking about and where they are at the present moment and whoever they are. But in terms of social networks, they're going to continue, and they're going to get more tailored to the audience of those who have affinities with each other. So they're not going to stop. The question is whether they're going to make money. I look at it as a similar period to the bubble of 98, 99, 2000, 2001, where the internet was a play toy. Anyone that had a small business plan and wanted to sell underwear, and I knew a company in that business, could slap up a website and start selling. We all know that a lot of bad business plans got a lot of money during that period, but some survived and some have become quite large, productive companies. Social networks, I see, is similar right now. There's a lot of information flowing, but how much of it do you want? And quite honestly, if you're working, in most cases, you know, you can't sit there and watch everything that's coming through, even participate in it. So somewhere in the next year or two or three, you know, there's going to become more of a business model around these social networks. But most importantly, they're going to be more keyed to your individual taste of who you want to talk to, when you want to talk to them, and what you want to see.
And regardless of what unfolds, we're all going to have to choose how we decide we're going to adapt and try to leverage those tools for our own business.
I think blogging has been around long enough, and it's been around a good while. People may not realize that. But blogging is definitely something that is a part of mainstay life. And it is a good way to share information. And we'll see where all this goes.
Martin, we're about out of time, but I do want to ask you before we let you go, under what circumstances should someone in the business community get in touch with you and seek your counsel, and how do they go about doing that? How can they contact you?
Well, I'm currently in the stages of building a model that's involved in the legal community that plays off what the buyer wants. So
there's an idea.
I read the Wall Street Journal today. But my email address is mt@martintilson, that's martintilson.com, pretty simple. And my office number is 404-949-1991. I am constantly looking at information and talking to people, spending at least four meetings a day with decision makers, trying to get a handle on this entire change we're going through. And change is going to be a word we have to get used to. It's going to continue to change.
Well, Martin, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show. I hope you'll come back and visit us sometime.
You guys are a lot cooler in person than I heard on the radio. I like it.
Until next time, this is Stone, Todd, Lee Cantor, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.